WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. New York, it's a city that inspires strong feelings. Now it's inspired a new passionate history called Gotham. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan spoke with Gotham's co-author, Mike Wallace.
In 1774, John Adams was attending the Continental Congress held in New York City. Adams anticipated the criticisms of later generations of visitors to the city when he complained, "With all the opulence and splendor of this city, there is very little good breeding to be found. There is no modesty. Their talk is very loud, very fast. If they ask you a question, before you can utter three words of your answer, they will break out upon you again and talk away." But despite the rude natives, the crowding, the crime, the dirt, New York City, more than any other city in the United States, perhaps even the world, fascinates people. My guest, historian Mike Wallace, is someone who has irretrievably fallen under New York City's spell. For the past 20 years, Wallace and his collaborator, fellow historian Edwin G. Burroughs, have been working together on a narrative history of New York City. The result, published this month, is an absorbing 1,383-page book called Gotham, A History of New York City to 1898. Volume 2 of Gotham, which deals with the history of New York in the 20th century, is in the works. Mike Wallace, welcome to Fresh Air.
Delighted to be here.
How did two historians have the chutzpah, and there's a good New York City word for you, to sit down and try to write the history of New York City?
Well, I have to tell you that, in fact, in the beginning, this was an even more lunatic enterprise. We sat down to attempt to write the history of the U.S. of A. at much the same level of telling a story, narrative detail, and we put in several years and churned out hundreds and hundreds of pages, and we realized that this was a project that would take about 11 lifetimes. We only had about two between us. So first we got depressed, and then we decided that we would decant this larger story into what, in our, you know, insanity, seemed like a more manageable topic, which was the history of New York City. But New York City considered in a national and in a global context, so that all of that work that we had done would actually be able to inform this enterprise.
I would imagine, in fact, I know that the two of you would want to do more in this book than just synthesize the work of other historians, which, I mean, you do a beautiful job of, but that you would want to put your own stamp on this history of New York. Can you give us a sense of the approach that you took as a historian to telling the story of New York?
Well, I do think it's important first to pay homage and honor to the literally thousands of people. The horrifying bibliography in this is got 2,500 entries. And it's that collective labor that has made this possible and also gave us the courage to, in fact, undertake this. There has been an explosion of fabulous work that's been done in every single area you can imagine: economic history, political history, cultural history, sexual history, family history, crime. But it's all been done pretty much in isolation one from the other. Academics have to tunnel their way through their subject, and they often have to talk in specialized language and jargon, which advances the actual work in the field, but is, alas, incomprehensible to most other people. So we had two goals. One of them was to, in fact, take this stuff, which is locked up in academic monographs and obscure learned journals, in doctoral dissertations, and put it into accessible language, and to connect things that are usually dealt with in isolation. So this is about sex and sewer systems and politics and finance and crime and architecture and banking and family life and, you know, you name it. If there's 8 million stories in the Naked City, virtually every one of them is in here. But the overarching goal was, in fact, to make this available to a general public. I mean, I myself have spent a fair amount of time during the course of this project working with museums, with places where popular culture is done, both analyzing the kinds of messages about history that get presented at places like Colonial Williamsburg or at Disneyland or in documentary films, and trying to work with that community of so-called public historians to get things out the latest scholarship out to, you know, real people. And historians, scholarly historians in the 19th century used to do that brilliantly. The Bancrofts of the world wrote exquisite literate narrative prose. We sort of lost that over the last 50 years, partly because, again, we were embroiled in this collective enterprise of rethinking, really, U.S. and New York history. The best thing that I hear repeatedly now, I'm beginning slowly to believe it, is that people enjoy this book, that they have fun, that it's a page-turner, that it reads like a historical novel. And indeed, you know, it's really only the novelists who can bring all of these different areas together and present economics and find all the rest of that stuff as lived experience, which is the way it actually happens for people. All of these things happen at once. So we're not up to novelists' standards, but... So far, if there's some wood about, I'll knock on it. So far, people really seem to, you know, like it. And that's the best thing that that I've heard so far.
Yeah, well, you really have recovered, I think, some of that, that drama and the narrative force of 19th century histories when people used to read history books as though they were novels and vice versa.
For fun.
For fun, right. But I know that you're a founding member of Radical History Review. I know from reading Gotham that one of the things that you're interested in is writing history from the bottom up. You also gave me as a reader a real sense of the clashes of the different classes, races, religions in New York City from the beginning. And that's one of the things that I learned, one of the many things I learned from this book, just how diverse a population New York City had from its very, very first day.
Absolutely. Again, both of us, and I mean, I did spend a lot of time working on this journal, and basically it's coming out of the 1960s and 70s. And history, which used to be, it was grand in the 19th century, but it was also pretty delimited in its subjects. We looked at the great political movers and shakers, or the great bankers and so forth, and which is, you know, crucially important. But what happened in the 60s, and in tandem with many voices in the country saying, hey, we're being left out of the national conversation, there were also voices saying we've been left out of the national history. And so suddenly black history was discovered, and suddenly, oops, we left out 50% of the population. And it's not just that you add women back into the picture, it's that when you do that, the entire story is transformed. Furthermore, you begin to broaden your definition of what your subject areas are. You know, now you're interested in family life, which was nobody cared about much in the 19th century, except for a few female historians. And you're interested in shopping and consumption history and retail, and which leads you to think more about communication and media and popular culture. And so, you know, there's been a glorious prying open of the range of subjects that historians have covered. This book, then again, is an attempt to incorporate various actors. So indeed, the immigrants are not the theys who are coming into our territory. Women are not, you know, some sideshow. Blacks are central to the question because, you know, this town was built really in some considerable measure on slavery. And we also expand the range of subjects. And we also, in fact, focused heavily on conflict. And one of the things is that we look at the same historical moment often from different perspectives. So we'll be in one chapter looking at the genteel lifestyle of the emerging upper classes in the 1830s. And then the next chapter, we'll be looking at what's happening across town in the Five Points with the Irish immigrants and life on the streets. And we're not hammering people over the head with this, but you can see by the lived experience that the one side of town is into genteel domesticity and have the resources to afford these nice brownstones and develop a new sense of privacy, whereas on the other side of town, you know, they're poor. The women, in fact, are in the streets a lot, helping one another out. There are dense social networks. And we also show how the vision then from the genteel side looking across town is of unmitigated squalor, and also how from the other side it's unmitigated privilege. And, you know, New Yorkers, I mean, it's the case everywhere, but New York has been famous from the get-go for these phenomenal juxtapositions of wealth and then, of course, various nationalities. And they're all fascinated with each other, and they always have been. There's a mutual voyeurism.
They're fascinated and they're afraid. I mean, there's also a lot of anxiety.
There's every imaginable possibility. Yeah. There is fear, either if you're in the upper classes, there's fear of explosion, there's fear of crime, there's fear of political takeover because there's many more of them who can vote. There's also arrogance. There's also condescension. There's also paternalism and benevolence and good-hearted attempts to uplift and improve the lives of the poor. And on the other side, you know, you get poor people who are enraged, want to blow things up. You get people who want to organize labor unions. You get people also who desperately want to become rich. but you can't tell the story from one perspective. You could, but it would be thin and boring.
Well, I want to get into some of these clashes and riots and all of the other dramatic moments that help make New York what it is. But let's get to the $24 question, though. Is it true that that Dutch settlers bought Manhattan for $24 worth of wampum from the Native Americans?
Yeah, yes and no. No, in the sense that, of course, it wasn't dollars. It was 60 guilders worth of trade goods. They weren't beads. They were probably given what we, because we don't really know, but probably given what other similar transactions involved, they were what we would now call high technology transfers, you know, axes and stuff, which technically, therefore, incalculable in their value to the folks on the other side. There's no question they did not pay a lot of money for this place. More important, I think, is the delight that New Yorkers take in an anachronistic reading. Hey, we ripped these guys off. You know, this was going to become the most valuable real estate in the world, and we got it for a song. So there's a little racial condescension here. Although, in fact, it's arguable that the Indians who made that transaction actually didn't even reside here and sort of took advantage of these guys and made a quick, you know, a little money. But I think the deeper point is that it signals, it's taken as our primal deal, you know, and it's at the center of our cultural genetic material. We see ourselves as a city of deal makers, and this was the founding deal.
Historian Mike Wallace has collaborated with Edwin Burroughs on a monumental new history of New York City called Gotham. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Mike Wallace. Together with his colleague Edwin Burroughs, he's written Gotham, A History of New York City up to 1898. Well, in addition to characters, human characters, you've also got some animal characters who seem to recur throughout the history of New York. And I'm thinking about pigs and the role they play in the history of New York in terms of sanitation and also, it seems like, women's rights to earn a living. And tell us about pigs and hogs and the hog riots of the mid-19th century.
Pigs were, in fact, the poor people's food. And in the very early days, when you were an artisan family, you had a little backyard, you just kept your pig back there. But as the city grows, the poor just let the pigs forage in the streets. The new genteel classes are freaked by this, partly because, of course, there's very uncouth beasts and they are copulating in the street, and this is violating the new genteel sensibilities. So they decide that they're going to have hog roundups, and they start sweeping these hogs up from the street. But the largely Irish women who are tending these people, they know that they're there, and they have sort of, you know, roundups every now and then. And there are huge fights between the nascent police force and these enraged women whose property is being confiscated. And in fact, most of the time, the women are successful in saving their bacon. It's only by mid-century and on that the forces of sanitation get stronger, because obviously there are also ties and connections between animal. There's a lot of dead hogs in the street, like dead horses in the street, thousands of dead horses in the street. This is an animal-powered and animal-fed place. And it's also a time when there are still cows being driven through the streets, because pre-refrigeration, you can't have cows coming in from somewhere else. So the slaughterhouses have to be right next to the city. none of this helps when you're dealing with a city that's prone to cholera plagues and fever plagues and such not. So eventually the forces of public sanitation drive the pigs to the northern part of the city and then eventually off the island altogether. But it takes a century.
People who study New York ultimately have to confront the big question, which is New York City America? A lot of critics say that New York is our most European city and that it's an anomaly in the United States. Other critics, other historians argue that New York City is the most American city because it's the city in which the promise of democracy seems to really come to life. You rub shoulders with everybody on the streets of New York. Where do you stand on that question?
I straddle it. I think the latter is the real truth, that the city, I mean, let's face it, it's not the good neighborhood club. I teach in a college that's in a public, the City University, and I start my classes by doing a little ethnic census and asking, you know, who here with one of their ultimate great-great-great-grandparents fitted in with this particular group. And we sort of march down in chronological order. And virtually every semester, I've got people who are Indians, not Dutch. Dutch are hard. But English and French and German and Irish and Italians and Poles and, you know, and on into the new world of Filipinos and Indians and Ecuadorians and so forth. And I say, you want to know the story of New York? Look around this room. Now, also notice that so far, at least, this class has been relatively amicable. Before we're finished, you know, we may be at each other's throats here and there, but it is the ability for all of us to be in the same space and with minimum, at least, civility that is what is incredibly exciting about this place. And it took 300 years, in fact, to develop that. So the draft riots were one moment when, in fact, the people were at each other's throats. There were innumerable other occasions when New Yorkers clashed. But one of the consequences of all of this battling and, at the same time, attraction. Because, you know, you're cheek by jowl with your putative enemy. That means sometimes you fight. It means sometimes you make love. And A.B.'s Irish Rose and West Side Story and such is a literary tradition that's coming out of that understanding that opposites attract as well. So it's I think it is the incredibly exciting collisions and connections between this myriads of people that generate this tremendous kinetic cultural energy, which means that New York has been a source of incredible, fertile cultural creativity. And in fact, many of the things that are created then go out onto the road. And they range from anything, and then are seen as quintessentially American.
Right.
So, you know, many of the deep popular songs out of the heartland are being written on Tin Pan Alley by Eastern European Jews in conjunction with, you know, African blacks, in conjunction with Irish entrepreneurs. But then, in fact, they become putative Americana.
Well, it strikes me now as we're seeing all these disaster movies, as we have been for the last couple of decades, whenever a filmmaker wants to show the United States being threatened, they show the monster stepping on the Chrysler Building or the spaceship landing in Flushing Meadows. You know, right. It's always New York, it seems, that's being destroyed.
Well, actually, there is a long tradition of disaster, not movies in those days, but disaster books. And there were some really quite astonishing ones. To some extent, one of them, Caesar's Column from the 1890s, which has this wild ending, which is class war and ethnic war and racial war, with a great bonfire in Union Square when, after the masses have been maddened and seized all the rich people and killed them in huge numbers, and they stack their bodies up in this pyre and they pour cement and concrete and it reaches up to the sky. You know, it's a horrifying vision. And it was one of the best sellers throughout the United States. Now, to some extent, it reflects that anti-New York animus. There are a lot of people out there who say, you know, this place is a collection of all these foreign people, and there's blacks, and there's more than that. There's Tammany Hall and corruption, and there's the drink and liquor interest, and there's gambling, and there's sex. This is a wide-open, crazy town. Now, to some extent, I think people in the Midwest or in the South or wherever are laying off on New York some of the vices which, in fact, alas, are far more general and can be found in their own neck of the woods. And that's part of the thing. And yet at the other side of that was, in say, in the 1880s and 1890s, they were hanging on New York society. Mrs. Mm-hmm. Astor and what the 400 did, this was being devoured by farm girls in Montana reading the newspapers, the national newspapers, which are coming out of the National Media Center. And so people are fixated on the place in both, you know, antagonism and admiration and emulation. And, you know, there's real dependencies here. From the 1830s, when you wanted to begin building canals out in Ohio, they didn't have the money. The money was in the Eastern Seaboard. So you went to Wall Street and you borrowed the funds. Mm-hmm. Now, on the one hand, you were pleased to get the funds because you could build things. On the other hand, you were in hock to these people, and the grasping money, you know, image of Wall Street bankers had some reality to it.
Right.
And they would foreclose on loans in hard times. And so, you know, Wall Street was detested because it was the center, and yet you needed it and you had to turn. So there's been this astonishingly complex love-hate mm-hmm. relationship, and it continues, of course, dramatically into the 20th century. But then, in fact, the balance of forces begins to change.
Well, Mike Wallace, as one New Yorker to another, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today on Fresh Air, and I'm looking forward to Volume 2.
Thank you. I'm delighted to have been here.
Mike Wallace is the co-author of Gotham, A History of New York City to 1898. He spoke with Fresh Air's book critic, Maureen Corrigan. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.